Okay, let us start with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, today is May 12th, 2012. Okay, so good morning, everybody. Now, today we're going to be taking primarily sutta number 71 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Te Vijja Vachagota Sutta, and it's translated as to Vachagota on the threefold true knowledge. And this sutta is concerned with the kind of vexed question that has come down in the Buddhist tradition, which is the question whether the Buddha was omniscient. You know, within the Buddhist tradition, in Pali, the Theravada school of Theravada Buddhism, we speak about the Buddha as having reached sabbanyuta, which means omniscience. I'll put this on the board. Yeah, the word sabba means all, and then it's joined with a kind of stem, new, which is based on the verb, which means to know. So sabbanyu means all-knowing or omniscient, and sabbanyuta means omniscience, or the state of knowing everything. And so it's within the sort of mainstream Theravada tradition, it's held, you know, in works like the commentaries or even some of the earlier canonical works, that the Buddha had, it said that all dhammas, all phenomena in all their aspects come into range of the Buddha's knowledge. And then even in Mahayana Buddhism, they're not even satisfied with simply ascribing omniscience to the Buddha. But I've read that, according to some of the Mahayana commentators, that every hair pore of the Buddha's body is omniscient. But let us see what the canonical texts, you know, the earliest documents, have to say about the Buddha's possession of omniscience. And it's not even certain that they're completely consistent with one another on this question. So this sutta, number 71, actually begins a series of three suttas in which a wanderer by the name of Vachagota comes to question the Buddha. And there are other suttas and other nikayas in which Vachagota is questioning the Buddha. So it seems like this was a wanderer who had met the Buddha on numerous occasions, and he was always like a little bit like a speculative philosopher, always troubled and disturbed by these speculative questions. And so we see him in many suttas asking these very abstruse philosophical questions of the Buddha. And then finally we see in sutta number 73, the Buddha gives an explanation to him which rouses his confidence, and then Vajragupta becomes a monk and then achieves arhatship. So this sutta 71 seems to be the first in this series where this wanderer is meeting the Buddha. Okay, so here the Buddha was living at Vaisali in a place called the Great Woods, the Great Forest, in a hall with a peaked roof. And then this wanderer, Vajragupta, was staying in a nearby park. And then one day, when the Buddha went into Vaisali for his alms round, it was still too early. And so he thought to go over to meet the wanderer Vajragupta in the park where he was staying. Okay, so the Buddha goes to Vajragupta, and Vajragupta welcomes the Buddha. Apparently this isn't their first meeting, because Vajragupta says apparently he knows the Buddha from previous encounters. So he welcomes the Buddha, prepares a seat for him, invites him to sit down. And then he says to the Buddha, now we come to paragraph 5, he says, Bhante, Venerable One, I have heard this, that the recluse Gotama, Gotama is the Buddha's family name, claims to be omniscient and all-seeing, to have complete knowledge and vision thus, whether I am walking or standing or sleeping or awake, knowledge and vision are continuously and uninterruptedly present to me. Then Vajragupta says, to those who speak thus, report your word correctly. Do they explain in such a way that there would be no ground for censors, for censor, for being blamed based on their statements? Okay, so Vajragupta has heard a report that the Buddha claims omniscience, and omniscience of a particular type. That is, he claims to have omniscience all the time, continuously, without any interruption, so that he's knowing everything at every moment. That's the report that Vajragupta has heard. And the Buddha replies, he says, those who speak thus do not say what has been said by me, but misrepresent me with what is untrue and contrary to fact. Okay, now there was a teacher in the Buddha's time who, according to the Buddha's text, actually did make that claim to omniscience. That is, he claimed to be able to know everything all the time without any interruption. Who was that teacher? Anybody know?
Nigantha
Nataputta. Yeah, Johnny got it correctly. Nigantha Nataputta, who is regarded as the founder of Jainism, or at least the most famous Jain teacher of ancient period. It's a question to me whether the Buddhist texts are actually representing the founder of Jainism correctly. Because what I found, when you read the Buddhist texts, when it comes to the discussions between the Buddha and the Brahmins, the Buddha will reject some of the claims of the Brahmins, but there's always a certain like respect or regard for the Brahmins. But when it comes to the Buddhists and the Jains, the Buddhist texts become quite caustic in their representation of the Jains. And so it could be that the Buddhists are not the Buddhist texts are not representing the Jains correctly. The Jains do claim for their founder an omniscience, but it's a question whether this is omniscience in the sense of knowing every particular fact continuously all the time. Okay, so in any case, the Buddha rejects this particular kind of omniscience. He rejects continuous and uninterrupted omniscience in every condition and every state all the time. Okay, so now Vajragupta asks the Buddha, how should I speak that I may say what has been said by the Blessed One and not misrepresent him with what is contrary to fact? So now he wants to know from the Buddha, to get it from the Buddha's own mouth, how the Buddha would explain his own capacity regarding knowledge. And so now the Buddha replies and he says, if you want to represent me correctly and not to distort what I say, this is what you should say. You should say that the recluse Gotama has the threefold true knowledge. The threefold true knowledge, in Pali, this is called te vija. The first part, te, means three, and vija means a kind of higher knowledge, superior knowledge. In fact, even in Sanskrit, it's used for any kind of, today it's used for any kind of knowledge or science. So, bhuta vidya is the science of the elements or physics. Maybe jiva vidya would be the science of life or biology. So if you know the account of the Buddha's enlightenment, this traditional account that comes down in the text, we read that after the Buddha entered into the jhanas, the deep meditative absorptions, then he directed his mind to the recollection of past lives, and he remembered his previous lives. Then he developed or aroused the divine eye by which he could see beings passing away and taking rebirth. And then he attained the knowledge of the destruction of the defilements. So those are the three types of true knowledge. And so now here, the Buddha is going to explain these three knowledges. Here the text is abbreviated, but we could go to the original source. He says, for insofar as I wish, I recollect my many past lives. That is one birth, two births, and we could go to 51:24. Then it just enumerates more and more numbers of births. Two births, three births, four, five, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000, 100,000 births, many aeons of world contraction, many aeons of world expansion, many aeons of world contraction and expansion, knowing there I had such a name, came from such a clan, such was my appearance, such was the food that I ate, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such the length of my life. Passing away from there, I took rebirth elsewhere, and there I had such a name, such a clan, and so on, until passing away from there, I reappeared, I was reborn here. Okay, so thus, with their aspects and particulars, I recollect my many past lives. So that is the first knowledge, the knowledge to recollect one's past lives, or for the Buddha to recollect his past lives as far back as he wants. The second knowledge, I mean, that's a pretty, even though it might not be omniscience, but it's a pretty heavy knowledge. Okay, the second knowledge, insofar as I wish with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I see beings passing away and reappearing. That means beings dying and taking rebirth, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and I understand how beings pass on according to their actions or karma. And we continue. On page 452, section 25. So he directs the divine eye to the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings. Then he understands how beings pass on according to their karma, thus that these worthy beings who behave badly in body, speech, and mind, who revile the noble ones, who held wrong views and acted on the basis of their wrong views, on the dissolution of the body after death, have been reborn in the lower realms, the bad destinations, even in hell. But those worthy beings who were well, who behaved well in body, speech, and mind, who did not revile the noble ones, who held right views and acted on the basis of right views, on the breakup of the body after death, they have been reborn in a good destination, even in the heavenly world. And so with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, he or the Buddha speaking about himself would say, I see beings passing away and being reborn, and so on, and I understand how beings pass on according to their actions, to their karma. Okay, so what is meant by the divine eye? The divine eye is a special faculty, a spiritual faculty, different from the fleshly eye, which is able to see things that are invisible to our physical eyes. And the divine eye is developed on the basis of the four jhanas, the four meditative absorptions. And it's developed by first mastering the four jhanas using, it said, the light kasina, that is, taking as the object of the meditation a ball of light. And then one practices that jhana over and over till one gets very clear, bright, a very deep meditative absorption with this clear, bright light. And then one takes this bright light and diffuses it outwardly. And it's said that this bright light is then able to illuminate things taking place at a great distance, so one can see things going on beyond the walls, you know, beyond the range of ordinary sight. Like if I want to know what's going on in Carmel or Cold Spring now, I could direct my attention to those towns and see what's going on there. Then I could see what's going on in New York City, who's winning the ball game this afternoon. Without a ticket, I can see the ball game. Get into Lincoln Center and see, you know, concerts without a ticket, but an honest person wouldn't do that. And then one could see things going on in other realms of existence. So one could use that bright light to illuminate different, what I call, frequencies, the other frequencies on which other planes of existence are occurring. It's just like if we have, you know, if I have a computer here and there's a wireless system, I can get many different websites. If I tell you that there are bands or vibrations coming into this room, giving the news in, you know, Spanish, Chinese, Japanese, Italian, Arabic, what other languages? Hindi, Swahili. You know, you say, I'm crazy. This monk is crazy. But if you have the computer and the wireless, you know, you just click on the, get onto that website, and then you get news broadcaster saying, Jin Tian. Xin Wan, is that what it is? Today's news? Jin Tian De Xin Wan. Or somebody saying in Sinhalese, Adhapravritya? And Hindi, of course, Hindi, I don't know. So speaking all of those languages, where are they? They're all taking place now. But, you know, without the wireless computer and without clicking into the right website, we don't see or hear those news programs. And so all of these other realms of existence, you know, they're not up in space, they're not down in the ground, they're all right here. But we don't see them because our eyes are just like our, you know, minds without the computer. But when you develop the jhanas and then use that bright light to illuminate these other frequencies, these other levels of vibration, then you can see what's going on in the heavens, the ghostly realm, the hell realms, all becomes visible. And then with the divine eye, one could also see how beings in all these different planes of existence are passing away and taking rebirth, and one could see how their rebirth is conditioned by their behavior, their actions in their previous life. So that the unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind will lead to lower types of rebirth, and the good behavior or wholesome actions of body, speech, and mind will lead to superior or happy types of rebirth. Okay, so these are two types of higher knowledge which are still mundane according to the Buddha's teaching. That is, they don't on their own, they don't lead to, directly to liberation. But the Buddha achieved them on the night of his enlightenment. And also many of the disciples of the Buddha also achieved these. They're not unique to the Buddha. Okay, then comes the third true knowledge, the third superior knowledge. In paragraph of section 9 here, he says, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I here and now enter and abide in the liberation of mind, the liberation by wisdom that is taintless with the destruction of the taints. We find this explained more fully in Sutta 51. Here the Buddha speaks about how he achieved this knowledge with his concentrated mind. He directed his concentrated mind, the mind which had been concentrated by the practice of the four jhanas. He directed it to the knowledge of the destruction of the taints, and he understood, as it actually is, the four noble truths. And then as he was seeing and knowing the Four Noble Truths, then his mind was liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of what's called the taint of being, which actually means the craving for continued existence, and from the taint of ignorance. And when the mind was liberated, there comes the knowledge of liberation. He understands that the cycle of rebirth has been brought to an end. The holy life, the spiritual life, has been fulfilled. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of conditioned existence. So this is the knowledge of the destruction of the, I don't really like the taint so much. The original word is asava. The asavas are things that flow into the mind, or that flow up from the depths of the mind into active consciousness. And so I see the asavas as being the primordial defilements that keep the round of rebirth turning, that keep one bound to the cycle of rebirths. And so the three asavas are the asava, or flowing, or maybe we could call it the pollutant of sensual craving, the craving for sense pleasures, the pollutant of craving for continued existence, to go on in one realm or another realm, and then the craving, or the pollutant of ignorance, of not understanding the real nature of things, of not, especially not penetrating the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so these are the three asavas, and so the Buddha, through his enlightenment, has fully understood the Four Noble Truths, has fully understood the nature of the asavas, the pollutants, and by understanding them, his mind has become liberated, completely freed from the asavas. And so then he sums up in paragraph 10, he says, if you answer thus and you say that I, the recluse Gotama, am or have the threefold true knowledge, you'll be speaking truthfully, you'll be representing me correctly, and won't be distorting my words. Okay, at this point I'll ask whether anybody has any questions about this. Okay, good, then you take the mobile microphone.
Is it because the phrase said, for in so far as I wish? So whenever the Buddha didn't wish, he doesn't have omission.
But say this, I'm not sure. Sure.
Yes, the Buddha said, when people say he is omniscient and all-seeing,
yeah,
continuously and uninterruptedly,
yeah,
that misrepresents him, right?
Yeah.
So the reason, because he's not continuously and uninterruptedly, is because the phrase, as far as I wish.
Yeah.
So when there are times he didn't wish to know with the divine eyes, for example, he wouldn't be able to know people's previous lives and
That's a very good point. I'm going to just pass by your question for now, because some of the other then we want to look at some of the other passages, and that might shed some light on your question. Any questions, especially about the threefold true knowledge? Does it seem credible, or I know some people think nobody can know their previous lives, or we don't have any previous lives?
Yeah, I still can't really put those shoes on. I believe of experiencing that there are previous lives. I think so far I'm thinking that I'm a Westerner, and that's an Asian idea. But and I've been told to simply that's one of the things that you just put on a shelf and deal with later.
Yeah, if somebody has a lot of trouble accepting the idea of previous lives or rebirth, I'd say, I put it on a shelf, don't have to struggle with it. Mm-hmm. But as far as the idea of rebirth itself goes, I don't find that conceptually that it's a problem. As long as we sort of free ourselves from the assumption that consciousness is something which is created by a particular configuration of material particles. The way I see it, or the way I would explain it, the computer is very useful besides being useful for typing documents, but for providing analogies. It's like, in the computer, what does all the work is the central CPU, it's called the central processing unit?
Yes.
Okay, that's where all of the, what do they call the circuits?
Yes.
What are they called? Those miniature circuits?
Just
circuits. That's where all of the circuits are, that's where all the data is processed. But the electricity that powers the computer doesn't come from the central processing unit. But you plug the computer into the wall and the electricity is coming from the power generator someplace miles and miles away through the electric wires that comes into the computer. Or if it's the portable notebook computer, it might be coming from the battery. Okay, I see the central processing unit is analogous to the brain, and the power generator, the electricity that's flowing into the computer, is like the force of life and the force of consciousness. And so consciousness doesn't come from the body itself, but it comes from another body which has passed away, and then the stream of consciousness flows into this body at conception or sometime in the process of formation. And in this way, consciousness arises based on this body, but it's not created by this body. Come on.
But consciousness was dependent on conditions, eye consciousness because we have eyes.
Yeah, it is dependent on conditions, and its functioning is always dependent on conditions. And so within this particular life, consciousness functions in dependence upon the sense faculty, upon the rest of the body, in dependence on the object, and so on. But one of the conditions for consciousness to come into this life would be the passing away of the stream of consciousness in a previous life. So that consciousness passes away, or let's say that consciousness passes away from the previous life, and then it arises again within the new life. Okay.
What is the number 483 in paragraph 10?
483. Oh, in brackets, those numbers in brackets. Those are the page numbers of the Pali Text Society's Pali edition of the original text. So you see in the corner of the page 1483, that means volume 1, page 483.
When you're talking about...
Yeah, please.
When you're talking about the consciousness moving, you know, your analogy with the computer, is there a real-world time frame for the movement of the end of the consciousness in one body and the rebirth into the next?
What do you mean by a real-world time frame?
Like, does it happen instantly? Can it be a million lifetimes away?
You mean, can there be a time gap between the passing away and the re-arriving? Yeah, this is where, you know, the suttas themselves are not very explicit about that, but different Buddhist schools develop different interpretations of what happens between death and rebirth. Within the commentaries of the Theravada school, it's said that rebirth is instantaneous, that one moment death takes place, the next moment the rebirth consciousness arises. I don't find this very convincing, because it seems to me that, well, first it presupposes that exactly at the moment that somebody dies, that there will be a couple providing the right karma conditions for that person who has died, who are having sexual relations or who have fertilized an egg, so that that egg is available for that stream of consciousness to set into that new condition. And it seems to me unlikely that that is taking place. So I would tend to side with those schools that say that there's a kind of interval in which the consciousness remains in a subtle body, waiting for the right conditions to appear within the human world, if it's going to come back to the human world, for rebirth to occur.
Bande, you just mentioned the divine eye of Buddha is not unique to him. Some of his disciples.
Well, I said that the divine eye is not unique to the Buddha. That disciples also have the divine
eye. Are the divine eyes of the disciples are exactly the same of the Buddha's divine eye?
No, it's said that the range of the Buddha's divine eye is supposed to be much greater than that of the disciples. Similarly, with regard to the recollection of past lives.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is the ability to see previous life one thing? The ability to learn using karmic law of karma to see the relationship between good action in this life, good future life is another thing, or?
The way it's presented in the text, the ability to see how karma conditions one's destiny from life to life is an aspect of the divine eye. But it seems you have a good point here that I would say that probably the divine eye and its function of seeing things at a distance, even seeing other realms of existence, is still a coarser function. But the ability to see how karma works from life to life would be a subtler function of the divine eye.
Okay.
That's my assumption. Okay, we'll take one question from Dana, then I want to go on.
I'm completely enthralled with the idea of the divine eye. You see it on people, you know, Muslims and Jews too, right? The hand is the eye.
I see, yeah.
Muslims have the eye. Well, anyway, I'm very interested in the idea of nimitta, you know, kasina.
Nimitta, yeah.
Yeah, and that you, when you've been meditating long enough, you see that.
Yeah.
Is that the divine eye in each of us when we achieve that in our meditation, when we see the nimitta?
Yeah.
Is that the divine eye? Are we all capable of that? The experience?
Yeah, the nimitta itself is not the divine eye.
No, it's not.
It's not.
Sorry.
In itself, it's not the divine eye, but the nimitta arising means that the concentration is becoming very strong. And so by pursuing the nimitta, especially if it's the light nimitta to the level of the jhanas, then one is establishing the basis for the divine eye. Okay, anyway, I want to pass on. I'll just do these other questions, or maybe you can read the other questions here on your own. I want to move on to some other passages that relate to the topic of omniscience. And one interesting passage is in Sutta number 90. I'm just going to take passages out of the sutta and just we'll look at them together. Okay, it begins on page 735. It's paragraph number 5. Okay, King Basenadi comes to the Buddha and he says, "Venerable Sir," everybody have it? "I have heard this. The recluse Gotama says, there is no recluse or Brahmin who is omniscient and all-seeing, who can claim to have complete knowledge and vision. That is not possible." Then he says, "Do those who speak thus say what you yourself have said, or are they misrepresenting you?" Okay, now, this seems like, you know this game telephone that we used to play as children, where somebody tells, there's a line of children, and somebody tells, relates some incident to student B. Student B passes it on to student C. C tells D. Till when you get to the end of the line, the story has become very much distorted. So probably, maybe Vachagota went back to the park, told some of his colleagues, you know, "I just was speaking to the Buddha. The Buddha said this." One of them said, "Oh, really?" Then he told another group, who told another group. And so eventually it comes to King Basenadi that the Buddha is now saying omniscience is impossible. Nobody can claim to have it. But notice what's... And then the Buddha, he asked the Buddha, "Is that, are they representing you correctly?" And now the Buddha says, "Those who speak thus do not say what has been said by me, but misrepresent me with what is untrue and contrary to fact." So here you see, the Buddha is not denying the possibility of omniscience. But what is he denying? What is it that sort of got distorted in the transmission? Look back at Sutta 71.
That he has it all the time.
Exactly. That he has it continuously, uninterruptedly, all the time. Whether sleeping, waking, and so on. Okay, so now the Buddha is saying, it's not the case that I'm denying the possibility of having complete knowledge and vision. Okay, then somehow the sutta starts taking another track. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, and then we come down. King Basenadi asked, "Where did you hear this from?" And eventually it turned out that one of the court Brahmins has made that statement. Okay, then in paragraph 8, King Basenadi of Kosala says to the Buddha, he says, "Could something else have been said by the Blessed One referring to that and the person understood it wrongly? In what way does the Blessed One recall making that utterance?" And now the Buddha says, "I recall having actually made the utterance in this way. There is no recluse or Brahmin who knows all, who sees all simultaneously. That is not possible." Okay, so what the Buddha is denying here is simultaneous omniscience is not possible. And in the other sutta, what he denies is continuous and uninterrupted omniscience. So on this basis, what the Theravada tradition ascribes to the Buddha is what is called omniscience subject to his wish, which relates to the point that Bowe brought up, that if the Buddha wants to know something, then he directs his attention to it and he will know it. So in this way, his faculty of knowledge is unobstructed. So he can know whatever he wants to know, but there'll be, you know, millions of things that the Buddha doesn't have any interest in knowing. Like how many leaves are there in the trees of Duangyan Monastery? You know, not of any importance. Buddha, I have a problem with Microsoft Word. I'm trying to create a document with columns, but I want to get the heading centered without being shoved off to one of the columns. How do I get out of that problem? Is Buddha going to, I find maybe some hidden sutta someplace in which, you know, this is like the hidden treasures in Tibetan Buddhism. You know, this is the secret document of how to center headings without them getting pushed into columns. A problem I ran into yesterday, so if anybody knows, let me tell me how to do it. Okay, so at least the Buddha is sort of suggesting that it's possible to have omniscience. Then I asked you, or I sent some passages from a sutta as printouts. These are two suttas from the Anguttara Nikaya. I just took some selections of excerpts from them. Okay, sutta number 23, we have the statement that the Tathagata is another term for the Buddha, has fully awakened to the world. The Tathagata is detached from the world. Then going down a little bit, it says, bhikkhus, in this world with its devas, Mara, and Brahma, in this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans, whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, reached, sought after, examined by the mind, all that the Tathagata has fully awakened to or become fully enlightened about. So in a way, this is making a statement that the Buddha has fully understood everything that can be known through any of the senses, including the mind. And then there is the next sutta says, in this world with its devas, Mara and Brahmas and so on, whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, reached, sought after, and examined by the mind, that I know. Again, this is making what seems like a very bold claim to omniscience. And I have to say, I don't know whether, you know, even though these suttas are shown as having been spoken by the Buddha, we don't know, we cannot know, did the Buddha really say this, or did maybe a somewhat later generation who wants to extol the Buddha and exalt the status of the Buddha make statements like this, ascribing them to the Buddha in order to boost his stature, especially with the leader of the Jains claiming to be omniscient, all-knowing, all-seeing, to have uninterrupted knowledge and vision. So if the Buddhists were to, you know, hold to the idea that the Buddha claims to be a triple knowledge man. He only knows his past lives, the passing away and rebirth of beings, and the destruction of the defilements. You know, he's not getting the Academy Award, the Oscar for the most expansive knowledge. So we have to, you know, extend the knowledge of the Buddha in order to at least make him equal to the Jain teacher. But then it also is possible that the Buddha did make this claim. But I wouldn't take it in the sense that the Buddha knows all the facts of, you know, human history through so many generations up to the present, that he knows all the laws of chemistry and biology. But for me, what's satisfactory is to have, or as a basis for trust, is to accept that the Buddha has understood the essential truths that are to be understood and realized through the practice of the spiritual life, and that the Buddha teaches the ways that lead to harm and suffering, the ways that lead to well-being and happiness, the ways that keep one bound to the cycle of birth and death, and the ways that lead to liberation from the cycle of birth and death. So for myself, looking at this issue in a rather practical way, that is sufficient. And I don't have to struggle with the question whether the Buddha can help me solve my problems with Microsoft Word, or whether he could even write the instruction manual for the Word version of the year 2020. I mean, those are not really so relevant. Okay, we'll take a few questions. Richard?
Yeah. You're doing a complete version of the Anguttara Nikaya, right?
Of the Anguttara Nikaya.
Yeah. This doesn't have number 24, the Galactic Park, in it?
Maybe not, yeah.
It doesn't. 23 is there, but not 24.
Okay, yeah.
How is 24 available?
Okay, this is my advice for everybody. I don't like to promote myself, but you brought it up. An ad from the sponsor. I'm not working for Wisdom Publications, but I translate for them. If you go to the website of Wisdom Publications and you want to get a copy of the complete Anguttara Nikaya, it's scheduled to come out in September. But if you order before the middle of August, you'll get a 40% discount. When it gets published, it will be $75. It will be about close to a 2,000-page book, but it'll be 75 pages. It's close to a 2,000-page book. It'll be $75 plus postage. But if you order now, you get it for $45, and they cover the postage. So don't delay. I'll be checking with Wisdom Publications on Monday. How many orders did you get from the Carmel Cold Spring?
Do you have any copies now underneath the table?
The only copy that I have is a PDF on my computer, which is the proofs that I have to start checking.
So my question was, you were talking about, it seems like you were mentioning the computer and Microsoft and those types of things.
I'm not an agent for Microsoft.
So what you're talking about is more wisdom rather than knowledge, is that correct? So knowledge would cover the Microsoft and so how to do this.
Oh, I see. In relation to the Buddha's... Well, I'd say make a distinction between wisdom and knowledge, and what is claimed here is still it's a kind of knowledge, and it's said to be a knowledge that he claims to know whatever can be seen, heard, sensed, cognized by the mind. But I'd assume that this would be not knowledge of particular matters of fact, but knowledge of essential principles, particularly knowledge of the varieties of forms, sounds, other sensory objects, how they fall within the different realms of existence, and then, of course, the essential principles of impermanence, being subject to suffering, being non-self. So you could say that aspect is wisdom. Okay, maybe we'll have time for one more question, then we will have, for those who requested, the going for refuge ceremony. So any question? Okay, Matt here has the question.
The tastes that arise come from the physical body, laying the body, I believe, rather than something more abstract than consciousness per se. So if one is able to destroy the taste and then achieve that liberation, exactly how How is that consciousness then? Is it not returning? When the body dies, and that consciousness re-enters the stream of consciousness, how does it know that it doesn't return? That it stays in this non-return state, whatever that is.
Of course, that brings up a big question. And maybe we'll be touching on that question to some extent with the next sutta, sutta number 72. But let's just say that according to the suttas, when one destroys the taints, then one has, they call this a retrospective knowledge, by which one knows that the taints have been destroyed and that there's no more coming back to any state of being. So that knowledge is said to arise. Exactly how it arises, how it's self-certifying, that I don't know. But it seems that for those who attain it, it's sort of self-confirming. Okay, now we'll end the class a little bit early because we want to do the going for refuge ceremony. So we'll end with the sharing of the merits. I think the sheet was handed out. So we share the merits with the devas, the buddhas, the other spirits, and with the world. Okay, you could recite along with me. Akasata jabumata deva naga medhika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga medhika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu mamparam. Etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabhe devanumodantu sabha sampati siddhya. Etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya vichetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin.